We've all heard about the Fitbits, GoPros, sleep apps, and other digital trackers that create data points out of our everyday activities. But how did people self-archive before the digital? What does the era of digital storage do to our concepts of identity and self-representation? This is Molly Schwartz, and I'm here with Jacek Smolicki, an artist and a fellow PhD candidate at the University of Malmö. Welcome to this Medea Vox episode on life logging and the quantified self. So Jacek, something that not everybody might know about you is that you are actually a very practicing life logger. Why do you do these life logging practices?
Personally, I don't really consider myself a life logger. I think there is a big difference between logging and archiving. And if you look at the very term log, or its kind of etymological origins, it comes from a log, you know, like a wooden log that the sailors used to drop on the ships to measure the pace of the ship, to be able to kind of realize with what speed and what pace the ship is moving forward. So then they would log, they would observe the log in the water, and then they would write the observation in their logbook or something like that. So it's very much about measuring. It's very much about, in a way, quantifying, you know, your performance in a way. And archiving, I wouldn't say it's that much about quantity, but perhaps maybe more about quality. That's where I find kind of a friction between the term logging and then the term archiving. And my practices have nothing to do with advancement of my performance of myself. It's more like trying to create aesthetics or techniques for recording different aspects in a more kind of, I would say, idiosyncratic way that is perhaps more cryptic and more personal in a way, and it has nothing to do with digits. So to give you an example, for instance, I collect newspapers, freely distribute newspapers, and do some kind of automatic reading to use this kind of, you know, surrealist technique. And then I'm making a collage out of those little newspapers. And when I look at it, it kind of represents the week, you know, as I kind of experience it through the prism of those newspapers or some, you know, digital information or printed information. But of course, it doesn't have any quantifiable value, or it doesn't have any, it doesn't really improve my life in any sense. It's more of a record, a kind of, you know, diary, I would say.
What about the sound bites? Do you record sound bites regularly?
Exactly. So every day I would record 1 minute of a soundscape that I'm attracted to. So by doing that, I'm trying to create maybe slightly different approach to how we document reality. I feel like we are so obsessed with the visual. We take, you know, 300,000 pictures a day and, you know, consume it immediately. There is no sense of reflection. And my audio recording practice redirects my attention to the audible, in a way, to the oral. And then by doing that, I can skip the whole visual assault in the public space, for instance, and be more present in terms of the sound. And then I obviously use that sound later to, for instance, compose different kind of longer, you know, compositions, or create some kind of more immersive installations and things. But again, For the external audience, this sound might be quite abstract. It doesn't really say anything. But for me, this 1 minute of a sound that represents a day is a wormhole to the past, in a way. It reconnects me with a very concrete situation.
Yeah. So you record a minute of sound every single day.
Yeah. Since July 2010.
So to me, that's crazy. That includes a tremendous amount of discipline and kind of regimentation. And it's, in many ways, quite distinct from the life logging practices that people are using now that I do kind of consider life logging, where they're using quantified self apps or things that are just automatically generating data about their everyday activities that's not necessarily intentional. So for you, do you feel like these kinds of practices of self-archiving, how do they relate to your actual life? Would you say they're an enhancement and a natural extension, or more like a disruption of your everyday activities because you have to remember to record a minute of sound?
Yeah, I think you touched upon the very interesting attribute of life logging that again, I think make us differentiate between archiving and life logging, which is automation. I think if you look at the definitions of life logging, it's very often an automated life log that happens passively, kind of latently, you know, in the background of your life. You accumulate data without really knowing that you're accumulating it. It's actually your devices and the cloud that takes care of your archive. Archiving that I'm trying to propose is more manual, in a way, or more effortful, you could say. So you have to kind of program yourself, you become an algorithm in a way. You know, you don't adopt an existing, you know, off-the-shelf systems, but you create your own, and according to your own conducts, you then execute it. And I think that keeps you, at least it keeps you feel that you have some form of agency over how you're being represented, you know, and how you can live your life in a more creative and productive way, maybe with digital technologies that, you know, are surrounding us, whether we want it or not, and create accounts of our lives, whether we want or not. And I very often kind of perform my practices in the moments of, in these little gaps where I have nothing else to do, so to speak. So it's also a way of counteracting the fragmentation of your life that is performed upon you, and you have to kind of adjust, like, you know, work, for instance, taking public transportation, being reliant on existing kind of timetables and existing fragmentation of time. But then, you know, you find gaps in between where you bring your own poetics, so to speak, and then that makes you feel like there is another dimension where you can create your own understanding of reality, and, you know, in a parallel way.
It's in those gaps that you take the time to record sound bites. In those gaps, I'd say that's exactly when I'm checking on my little data apps. That's when I'm scrolling through my Twitter analytics or things like that.
I mean, that's exactly what I would try to say that constitutes my practices. Like, another example is here in Sweden, not only here, but when you enter Tube in Stockholm, for instance, I would say 80% of people are immediately drawn to their devices, and you just see them scrolling, and it's becoming obviously more and more present. And then to resist that, I have a little paper notebook, which I use to draw the people that are drawn to their devices. So it's a way of capturing the digital culture by the means of analog devices. And then trying to kind of also think about, what if we didn't have all these devices? What if at some point the digital collapses and we are all of a sudden in the state of post-digital? And how would we then go about, you know, using our free time, for instance? So it's also a way of trying of populating free time by, you know, something alternative to what is being proposed to us constantly, in a way. But Molly, I feel like I've been talking so much. I would like to ask you, since you're a researcher that is coming from a very particular background, I would say, since you've been studying to become an archivist in the traditional sense, so to speak, not life logger. And you've been involved in many projects that have to do with digital preservation. You've been working as a data analyst for the State Department. So you have a very interesting perspective, I guess, on data, and particularly on the problem that I find super interesting, which is to what extent our data is private, to what extent is it public or corporate, so to speak. How do you find these frictions, and how would you recommend people who would like to, I don't know, create some kind of personal archives that are informative and have some value for them, to maybe, I don't know, resist being their data being pulled into other domains? I don't know. I'm just very curious about how you perceive that friction, private, public, of personal data.
Yes, of course. So as you mentioned, coming from the background that I come from, I came in with a deep faith in kind of the power of data and the power of information, and the idea that the more knowledge that was available to people, the better they would be able to make their lives. And so I've been involved in a lot of kind of data activist activities, open data movements. And I would say that in the end, I felt like dealing with this concept of personal data was completely unavoidable, both on a practical level. So, for example, a big impediment to implementing open data projects within the government was the fact that there are very specific laws governing what the government can do with pieces of data that are considered personal. So they can't open data sets back up that contain personal data. When I was working for the State Department, different agencies within the government actually have different legal teams who have different ideas about what consists of personal data and how you can treat it. And we actually had a quite strict legal team. So even data that would be considered public, so for example, data that you could scrape from Twitter, we were required to anonymize all of it. So we couldn't necessarily even have in any automated or database format names of people, even if they were publicly putting their name on a piece of information, or even not their real name, but their Twitter avatar or whatever. These were issues that were unavoidable and kept popping up, and they were something that I became more invested in, especially as I saw that people, whether it was legitimate or not, seemed to have a lot of confusion or ignorance or fear around ways in which their data were being collected. And so that prompted me to get involved in this initiative in Helsinki at the Helsinki Institute for Information Technology that's trying to create a way for people to have more direct control over their personal data management, because I think that's necessary for us to really do some of the innovative things that I think can happen around big data sets, but do it in a way that's ethical, that's with people's approval, that involves some levels of consent. And also, to that end, I think it's really important for people to try to inform themselves as much as possible. And I've been involved in some things like crypto parties, which are self-organized events, but really for the purpose of educating people as to what tools are out there, like PGP for your email, or like chatting off the record, or these different things that are actually publicly available, but a lot of people just don't know that they can actually keep their communications private.
You mentioned more direct control over one's data. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So the concept that we've been working on at MyData is implementing certain protocols that have actually already been created. So things like user managed access, which is built off of some digital identity profiles like OAuth. And the idea is that as a person, you would have some kind of consent management platform that would allow you a real-time access to the different consents on your different levels of data. So to give a real world example, when people have loyalty cards at stores that they visit frequently and you swipe it every time you make a purchase, and most of us realize that the reason why businesses give us these loyalty cards is that they are keeping track of this data, and this data is very valuable for them because they can spot things in people's buying habits, and they will actually have a record of what you've bought at their store over time, and it tells things about your life. Now, one thing that we would like to see happen is that the people themselves would be able to have access to these data sets as well, because they might find them informative or useful, or they might just like to see what the heck are people collecting about me. And I think that actually removes a lot of the mystery, it removes a lot of the suspicion, and it doesn't do anything harmful to the corporation. If anything, it gives them, I would say, a more intense relationship with their customers, because it's more open and the customer can say, over time, well, before I used to let you have access to this data set, but now I've chosen that I don't want you to have it. So instead of just checking one time, this kind of terms of service box, that's a blanket agreement that doesn't allow for any adjustment over time and doesn't allow for very much transparency. Instead, it's more dynamic, active relationship.
Well, what about the fact that still the corporation has power over how to interpret the data? I mean, it has much more powerful tools and instruments to actually make use of the data than the individual. Like, if you're being given back your raw data, you don't necessarily know how to deal with it and what kind of sense to extract. I mean, you definitely have, you know, some agency and power, but I believe that corporations obviously have much bigger ones because of, you know, having also contextual data and other people's data, and so they can build kind of a bigger sense. So how do you find this lack of balance between, you know, creating narratives out of our data?
Yeah, definitely. So one thing that I think I would envision, as well as a lot of other people, is if you do have some kind of personal data management account like this that's run through certain protocols, almost like an email account, you would probably be able to choose between different platforms that offer different services. And I would imagine some of them would offer some kind of personal data analytics if you wanted to go for maybe a slightly fancier tool, or you'd have an option to self-host, just like you can self-host an email account. And so I definitely agree with you that a big part of the power of this data is the analytics that you can do. Now, one thing that I think would be interesting is that if you had this all correlated around yourself, you could actually be mixing different data sets that you have out there. So you could take your data set that you have from all your doctor's visits along with your data sets from your grocery store visits and things like that and create a narrative together. But also, I think this allows for people to consent for their personal data to be used for research. A big thing that I think this would do would be to let people who participate to let their data be used by research is it creates a mechanism by which the people can then get the benefits back from what the research tells them about their data. Because oftentimes now, if you give your data to some kind of research initiative, they use it and you never necessarily hear, what did they find out? How do I compare with all these other people in the study? Things like that. So it would create this kind of open dialogue.
I think that connects us to the movement of quantified self in a way, because I had a very ambivalent relationship to this whole concept. And then I decided to basically step into the community. So I first went to the Danish Quantified Self Movement meeting, and then I ended up also presenting at the Quantified Self Conference in in San Francisco, where I was talking more about aesthetics and maybe also long-term perspective on our data. And what struck me was exactly the issues that you touched upon, that, you know, quantified self, I think, in like from a more critical perspective, as we hear it, you know, being in academia is seen as something really negative, as people compulsively, in a narcissistic way, documenting their lives, and then, you know, for the sake of perfecting their lives in a way, and then that the whole thing is connected to some big industry that controls all those processes. And what I found out actually is quite the opposite. I think, like, at least people that I spoke to seem to be very aware of the fact that the corporations have such big power over our data, and the quantified self movement for them is a place where they can actually resist this corporational forces by developing their own applications, like very, very particular, very individuated in a way. So like I met one guy who has a very particular health problem, and there is no global solution for his health problem. So he needs to develop an application that synchronizes with his processes in a way. And that data is not accessible to anyone else except him, basically. And there are several, there are quite many examples of very kind of individuated personal data collection practices that quantified self, you know, people develop and talk about. And then the community or this kind of meetups function as places where they exchange knowledge about those very particular cases. So it has nothing really to do with a global control of our personal data, as some, you know, critical scholars tend to say. Of course, I mean, we can find a lot of examples of maybe saturated obsession with, you know, with believing in numbers in general. I think that's something that I'm a little bit skeptical about, that the slogan that, you know, there is some kind of a truth in numbers, and that's why we should trust our binary algorithms and processes in finding out about ourselves. But I think there are several depths to the problem. I wonder what you think about this particular practice.
I think that's super interesting what you say, and I also have been seeing a lot of examples of how people use quantified self techniques as a tool of subversion, exactly like you're mentioning, that they can somehow take control of some things that would otherwise be institutionalized. And that's a movement that's really significant, especially in the U.S., is people trying to take control over their own health processes and kind of subvert doctors, potentially. I also find it very interesting because on the one hand, I think it's great that people have these tools to create a more customized technique for dealing with their health issues. But on the other hand, you've seen that in some ways that might come to replace a level of accountability or a level of responsibility among certain professions. So for example, you'll see hospitals now testing out giving people Fitbits or giving people these different tools to monitor themselves. So basically, you're kind of outsourcing what the nurses would normally be doing to the patients themselves. And I think there actually so far is no clear direction of where this is going to go. So in terms of talking about how we have these different ways that we can collect data through our lives, what do you think? Do you think in general we have too much data or too little data in our personal lives now?
I think the more we have, the more we want, in a way. You know? So I think that it's a kind of a perpetual cycle. I think the more possibilities we have, the more perspectives we open up, I think, to have even more data. And I don't think there is a clear answer to that question, but I think it's a very individuated question. I think people should be perhaps asking themselves that question individually. And I've been talking to some people and researchers who deal with like digital literacy, for instance. And I feel like this questions that are kind of, you know, on the verge of maybe ethical questions and political questions and so on should be also introduced to education on digital literacy and how we live with our digital technologies. So I don't think there is a global big answer to that question, but I think it's very individuated. I think some people perhaps need more kind of productive relationships with technology, by which I mean relationships that produce data that is kind of significant to them. And maybe some people, I don't know, I have this kind of a stoic approach to technologies. I'm trying to not engage too much in digital technology. Personally, I'm quite skeptical to where we are heading with our network technologies. And I've been trying to suggest, you know, not getting too emotional about technologies. I noticed this split in attitudes towards personal data collections and all the politics around it, that, you know, people are either completely ignoring it and seeing it as an overblown issue. And then on the other hand, we have critique of what's going on and this, you know, movement that is trying to render technology and those who produce technologies as something negative, you know, inherently negative. And I feel like the best way of evaluating the progress of technological, you know, advancement is to basically stand still. You can kind of evaluate it in the best way by just standing still and kind of witnessing of what's going on, or like kind of not letting yourself go with the wind or against the wind, but try to find a balance. And I think maybe in terms of data practices, that's what we should also think of in a more metaphorical way. That perhaps also leads us to the question about the historical value of our data. And I know, Molly, that you've been trained in a strong belief in preserving, you know, our heritage. And I'm very much interested in the concept of personal digital legacy and, you know, what's going to happen with our data. Do we think of it, or is there anyone who thinks for us about what's going to happen with our personal data? What do you think about that?
This is something that I've thought about a lot, because obviously coming from an archives background, there's a strong mandate oftentimes to preserve the truth, to preserve the historical record. That's seen as a right that people have access to kind of the true version of their history. Obviously, that's been really problematized over time, because in the end, you have someone deciding what articles of information do you collect, how do you organize them, how do you provide access. There's always people making decisions about those, even though they are professionalized and institutionalized. There are people behind them who obviously come in with their own biases. But it's been fascinating for me to dive a little bit into the data analytics side and to hear about so many people who are so afraid about how their data is being collected and stored, and it's so easily recovered, because I would say that generally within the archives profession, there's a huge sense of chaos around this creation of digital data. There's a huge amount of data overload. People have a lot of questions about how to collect and organize born digital records. I mean, for a long time, there have still been institutions that I worked at who were printing out emails and saving the paper, because we know how to save the paper, right? You know? So I would say there is not at all an assurance that somehow we have these massive data troves that we're going to be able to save. Maybe there are some people who know how to do it, but it's not the, my experience is not necessarily the professionals who are meant to do it. So that's a big question for me. And it's also something that I don't know. This is a reason why I think it's valuable to have different stakeholders involved in how some decisions are made, because I would say that some of the technology companies that actually do have enormous amount of capabilities to collect and do analysis on data, they don't have the same mandate or the same viewpoint as archivists would. So they're looking at how to optimize this data for the purpose of, you know, how they're going to use it next week or next year, but they're not looking at how people are going to look at it 200 years from now, or if it'll even be accessible on the type of devices that people are using. So I think it's important to kind of open that dialogue between these different groups. And it's also something that I do wonder, what kind of story are these kind of data sets leaving? Because we are the first generation where there's real segments of the population and real even communities that have built up around quantified self. And you hear examples of universities who do something like, for a research project, give out a free iPhone to 20% of their student population in exchange for tracking the movements of those students. And then they'll go use that data to see how people are using the facilities on their campus, how they can improve things, what walkways need to be widened, things like that. So there's a very clear use for the data, but you wonder, what kind of historical story will this tell? Will it be meaningful? Is this going to be something that researchers are using? I certainly hope so, because I think it could be interesting, but as of yet, I think that we haven't come to an age where academics have that level of access to that kind of
exactly.
data set.
I mean, there's this interesting paradox when it comes to archiving personal data, because, I mean, the role of the archivist, we can agree, is to already select what's valuable in a way and representative to our times, right? So there is a selection of the content happening. But as Gordon Bell, for instance, you know, the Microsoft researcher who's been involved in this, perhaps one of the longest life logging experiments from 2004, I think, until today, he's been documenting every single aspect of his life as an experiment in what kind of value digital data has now and can have in the future. And basically, one of his conclusions is that we should collect as much as possible, because we don't really know what's going to be of value in the future. Mm. And like, what kind of systems for extracting value we'll have in the future. So for him, hoarding information in a massive scale is something positive in a way, which is kind of contradictory to what archiving is about. And it's quite interesting. And I'm trying to oppose that. And so that's why I'm also like, in my practice, I'm trying to be very selective. I limited my practices to a very concrete amount of, which is 12, And, you know, the principles don't change. There is some kind of a coherence, which I hope adds to its archival value. I'm thinking about it as already being structured while it is being kind of accumulated, as opposed to just, you know, hoarding things and then trying to find sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually, it's a big debate within archival philosophy. There was a pretty famous paper that came out that was called More Product, Less Process, that was basically trying to deal with the fact that we're in this era of massive information overload. And the idea was make as much product accessible to people as possible, even if it requires less processing. So even if you do less as an archivist to remove the paper clips and organize things in nice folders and create descriptions, instead just make it available to people and see what they will do with it.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, that's a similar attitude.
Yeah. But what do you think will happen with the profession of an archivist? Or do you think we will all become archivists in a way? I mean, you already have applications that allow you to archive things. You have a button archive, basically. Does that button make you an archivist today? Or?
No, I don't think so. I think the word archives is being thrown around a lot in ways that people who are archivists wouldn't necessarily consider true archiving. So, for example, the archive function in Gmail is not what I would consider actually archiving. But it does raise an interesting question that as our facilities for storing data become much more available and much cheaper, and as our powers of recall and sifting through things become more powerful, it does open the question, should we just save everything and figure that we'll be able to find what we want later on?
Exactly. I was trying to imagine the other day, how will a presentation of you know, some of my life in my 20s and 30s to whatever my grandchildren or whoever I will have a chance to present my stuff to in the future will look like. You know, will it be, for instance, going to, how do you call it, the archive machine, going back to Facebook logs and kind of scrolling down?
You know, look at my timeline, kids.
Exactly. as our parents used to, you know, bring the projector and maybe show us some slides from their childhood. Mm-hmm. What kind of storytelling techniques do you envisage for the future when it comes to transmitting, you know, our memory?
This is something that, even though I would say I do have a pretty big belief in the power of data, at the same time, I can't imagine what it's going to be like showing my digital photos to my grandkids or something like that. My memories that I have of my grandparents telling me their stories are so physical. They're so material. I remember sitting with them on their bed and looking through physical photo albums and hearing their stories. And you even kind of remember what the room smells like and things like that. And there is something about scrolling through the pictures on your phone or going through them on your computer that just doesn't feel quite the same. And what's interesting is that there are so many people I've talked to now who are really in a quandary about what to do with their digital photos. That's actually, a lot of times, there are some archives, institutions, and libraries that will have days that help people organize their personal information. So it's the idea of like, bring your photos in and we'll show you how to manage them or digitize them or whatnot, because it's a huge need that people have.
Yeah.
There are not easy ways to print them anymore, so a lot of people aren't printing them, but nobody has their photos organized, and it's just something that I don't see yet how it's going to turn out.
Yeah, can I show you one example from the archive? I'm curious about.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So Jacek has this huge black box here that is apparently his self.
I mean, so basically, I already mentioned a little bit about my skepticism towards digital technologies and my kind of disbelief in its kind of perpetual continuation. I feel like, you know, at some point we'll move on somewhere else. And I've been, you know, in my research, I've been looking into historical examples of how we used to go about archiving. And up until today, paradoxically, I mean, the most kind of durable way of archiving is obviously the analog way, which is through, you know, having things on paper printed using, for instance, natural pigments. So one of my practical cases that I'm developing is literally a case which consists of materialized data, selection of my digital data that is turned into a set of index cards printed on archival paper that is supposed to last for at least 300 years, according to the estimations. And that process is very interesting because it kind of forces me to bring another layer of selectiveness to my quite extensive data collection practices. And it also puts me in a very, you know, interesting rhythm, since, you know, it involves a lot of corporeal work and even mechanical work with cutting things and, you know, being away from the screen, being away from the internet. And yeah, I will demonstrate you one example.
Okay. So this is a physical representation of Jacek's self-archiving practices. He's opening the box.
Yeah, so it's a little portable case that allows me to travel and get into discussions about different implications.
It's on wheels too, it travels.
It's about 20 kilograms. So a little bit more than an iPhone. And then you have 12 drawers. Each drawer is hosting a selection of data coming from particular practice. So you have, for instance, the one that we talked about, which is the collection of sounds, soundscapes. So each, not really each, but the selection of sounds is printed out on the archival paper. And then each one is stamped and described. So here you have, I don't remember that sound. It's a graph representing the waveform on one side. So it's a very abstract thing. It doesn't really, you know, tell you what the sound is about.
Yeah.
But some of them, which is quite interesting, it's enough for me to look at, and I am able to reconnect with that day. Some of them
just
are
from looking at the sound
just
waves.
Just from looking at, exactly. So it's a way of encrypting, you know.
Now, if I use some kind of sound player device and I held it up to those sound waves, would it play the sound?
I mean, I was experimenting with this augmented reality applications, but they are, again, very shaky. And you know, the ownership is another issue here. Like, these applications migrate from one company to another, and you know, the terms of agreement changes all the time. So I kind of skipped that. But this cabinet is equipped with an offline network. It has a built-in router, which is a hacked router that allows you to access the digital content as well within the vicinity of the archive. So if you are in the same room, you can switch off your online connection and, you know, connect with the cabinet. And then by looking at this little description at the back of the card, you see a number and you see the indication of which place on the website you can find this particular data in, and then you just go there, you click,
you
this
listen.
One is number three, and you can actually
listen to
that sound. Exactly. And that's the same applies to other practices, like, for instance, there is a video one. It's a selection of 10-second clips recorded every day live, every day. Or this one, for instance, is about documenting particular days by extracting a GPS location. So this is, for instance,
little GPS maps of your movements.
And this is a selection of days. So like this one, I remember just by looking at it. This is Warsaw, the 20th of December, 2015. And I took a very nice walk with my cousin. And I actually, by looking at very concrete moments, I can recall conversations, you know, that I had with my with my cousin here, for instance. So like for me, this is, again, some kind of a mnemonic device that, you know, sends me back. But of course, for you, this is completely abstract little nonsensical graph.
But then if I connected my devices to your Jacek Smolicki local area network here, then I would be able to interact with the digital.
Exactly. You can interact with the digital content. I mean, you can access the actual GPS file as well and maybe see it more, you know, in the context of a geographical location. So it's a way of maybe encrypting, you know, your data by the means of, you know, disassembling the hardcore data and the metadata in a way, you know, or kind of a poetic metadata, which is the context that you possess within your body, within your mind in a way. And then you really have to be kind of there to get the whole picture in a way. Maybe it's also an attempt to kind of resist the fragmentation, you know, and of our data that tends to migrate to different contexts and lose its maybe initial value or intention.
And I would imagine, as you mentioned earlier, that simply the practice of archiving does something to embed these moments in your mind, because you're remembering specifically, you have to go through a process to make sure you record it.
Yeah, you mean the kind of
the
post-production.
Practice of, yeah. I mean, also the act of, for example, recording the sound makes it more likely that you'll remember that moment. And
yeah,
that sound.
That's true. Although I also noticed that just by, you know, having this principle that I have to record a minute every day, it makes me more aware of the space sonically. So like I feel like I'm paying more attention to the space in a way. And in a way, I feel a little bit like a hunter sometimes, you know, right?
Hunting for sounds.
Exactly. Yeah, and of course, there is also kind of a playful component to it. Like when I see that my walks you know, are boring, are kind of repetitive, then I would try to change my
so my they look nicer artistically.
Yeah, so it's a way of, you know, trying to control your record, but also letting the record control you in a way, you know, choreograph your movements in a way and so on. I'm using this cabinet now as a prototype, I'm calling it, which is a prototype that is intended to trigger and spark different conversations, just as one we have now, you know, with different practitioners, with different people concerned with archiving, privacy issues, and documentation, and so on. Are you going to build one for yourself?
I would like to. I would like Molly's cabinet of curiosities.
To wrap up, I guess maybe we should conclude in some way, but I would just ask you, Molly, what do you think the future of personal archiving is?
I would say that there will be a point where our devices and our services that we're using, unless we end up deciding culturally that we don't want to do so, will be collecting a record that they will probably make open back to us. It will be something that happens very unintentionally, as you were saying, very not mindfully, things that will just become kind of data doubles of our lives. But I do have optimism that over time people will become more informed about what data sets are being collected and will potentially have more access and more control over the management of them.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well, as I mentioned before, I feel like I don't find digital technologies the ultimate ones. I feel like there will be something coming after in a way. I feel like it's really up to us how much we want to dedicate our lives to living with digital technologies. I feel like it will be hard to change something in the overall kind of political dimension of the network culture, but I feel it's really up to us individuals to what degree we want to be involved and we want to contribute to the maintenance of the...
So even if we do have the potential to have all these devices that have all these data points, we shouldn't necessarily see ubiquitous computing or a world full of Internet of Things as inevitable. We should reflect,
yeah,
potentially or choose.
Maybe quite the opposite. We can just agree that it's here and maybe it will disappear, maybe not. But we should, regardless what's going to happen, we should maybe create our own individual stances towards that, you know? I think it was Brian House, the American artist, who said that the surveillance technologies are also for us in a way,
mm-hmm.
you know? And there is still space for subverting them and using them for our own for our own ends. And, you know, whether it's a creative approach, poetic approach, subversive approach, critical approach, and so on, I think there are different modes that we should also take into consideration. And we mentioned a little bit the issue of digital literacy. So I feel like maybe if we start educating people, with people are becoming more kind of aware of all this, you know, implications that we talk about, they will start recognizing that, you know, they have to themselves start deciding to what extent I'm going to use that device, to what extent, to how much time I'm going to spend, you know, in front of this device, and being aware, you know, that while documenting my life, I'm also being documented and certain data is not going to be accessible to me. Hopefully the you know, becoming more aware, for me, it's like an answer to some of the problems.
Well, thank you so much, Jacek, for this conversation and for actually bringing in your artwork for us today. This was great.
Thank you, Molly. That was great to be able to bounce some ideas and get into conversation about, I think, quite important issues.
And thanks to you all, dear listeners, for tuning in for another episode of Medea Vox.